welcome everyone to Rock'em Nation Podcast. Finally, a brand new episode of Dive Cuts. Deep into the season. We are on season 6. This is technically going to be episode 9. So we actually recorded episode 7, part 1, and episode 7, part 2, because the way the podcast service, I guess, works. Episode 7, part 2 with Blake last week was still, I guess, episode 8. So we didn't really have a choice in the matter there. So we are on episode 9, here to talk all about your Missouri Tigers and their basketball program. I am your host, Sam Snelling. With me, as always, Matthew J. Harris. Matt, how are you?
I'm about as tired as the players are from four games in 8 days, but we're going to power through with all the spreadsheets and clipping because I'm anal retentive like that.
Well, so we recorded a two-parter sort of SEC season preview, talked about a lot of teams. And because we had recorded two podcasts, I'm like, well, let's take the next week off since there are so many games. We're recording this Monday, November 14th. We have watched Missouri play basketball 3 times. We saw them defeat in the opener Southern Indiana, despite Southern Indiana's plethora of three-point shots. We then saw them defeat Penn. They overcame Penn, who also hit a plethora of three-point shots. And then we saw them basically just crush Lindenwood in the last 10 minutes of the second half of the game, as Lindenwood went absolutely ice cold. Final score there was 82-53. The first time that Mizzou's offense was held under 90 points. Their least efficient basketball game, but they also didn't have an opponent like shooting 50% from three-point range, so that helps. It was just one of those things where, as you're sort of watching, especially for me, I think more Southern Indiana than Penn, I felt like Missouri had more control of the Penn game. That Southern Indiana game was a blowout. And then all of a sudden, they're just hitting everything they were throwing up the rim. Got a little nervous there for a little bit. Matt, as we sort of made our way through 3 games, 3 wins, lots of offense. Do you have any initial takeaways that you want to get into?
They play really fast, which, after 3 years of hearing a staff profess, we're going to play fast, we're going to play up tempo, and then not doing so, it's been jarring, just not in a bad way, but just, it's just a reminder of how you get accustomed to a style of basketball over a period of time. And then, the first night, I think they came out and I think they had something like 30, secondary breaks and fast breaks and defense to offense situations. And it's kind of kept up at that same pace. They'll play the first 5 minutes. I think it almost looks like they script the first, 4 or 5 possessions. And then it's like, all right, guys, just go. And they go. And, sometimes, the byproduct looks a little bit haggard. Sometimes it's not always the best shot selection. But, I think we talked about this, just earlier today as we prepped, was it's nice to see, I think, a commitment to assertiveness and to see a team that says, we're going to play fast. We're going to, look to attack early. We're going to put the pressure on you and the onus on you to stop us. And we'll talk about, what that brings with it. But I think it's just, I won't want to say it's refreshing. I don't want to say anything's better or worse. It's different, but it's sort of, just sort of a reminder of, oh, this is what it looks like when you really do embrace pace and you embrace sort of, I think, just more broadly kind of a modern approach to playing offense. So it's been just sort of, I guess, just an adaptation process the first week to just, broadly how this team wants to play as a group.
Yeah, and I think like I think I expected them to play pretty fast and to sort of, you know, come out of the gates with a little bit of gusto. Interestingly enough, I mean, it certainly looks like Lindenwood is going to have a hard time adjusting. I don't think Southern Indiana is going to have a very hard time adjusting to Division I basketball.
They're a really good D2 program. They were really, really good last year, and they've been good over the past couple of years. So, yeah, I think they'll be able to. And the OVC is what usually I'd have to look at what they were last year.
Southern Indiana was where Pearl was, right?
Yeah. USI is in Evansville on the opposite side of town as UE. And had been known as a really, really good D3, then D2 program. Pearl has been there. I can't remember if there's another coach that had been down there, but it's really well respected as a D2 here. Really gets a lot of good in-state talent that's kind of gone there. And they built a new arena and they're scaling it up. And this is really wonky, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens there because UE is in town. University of Evansville is in town, really falling on hard times there, you know, ranked lower now than USI, which is making the jump, and then just
blow for blow with the Billikens the other night.
Went toe to toe with Travis's crew for about 30 minutes the other night, and then to the south is Murray State, and you know, and then just to the west a little bit is SIU over in Carbondale. So just a really, really interesting area. A lot of kind of solid mid-major programs. They're breaking in. They're kind of that, you know, blur between the OVC and the MVC, which has lost some teams. So it's a really interesting dynamic down there. I'm sure Missouri fans care deeply about this, but you and I as basketball nerds, it's just really interesting to watch them make that transition. I think that they're going to be better positioned than Lindenwood, because Lindenwood has, as an athletic department, has moved really quickly from the NIA level up. They've really...
And they weren't even good in Division II.
No, like, no, they weren't. And
now, granted, I mean, there's a lot of different reasons why you decide to you know, change levels, and you know, men's basketball is not always at the top of the list. But yeah, like they were not good, and I want to say it was like the Great Lakes.
Yeah, they were.
Great Lakes Valley.
They aren't.
Conference.
They aren't UMSL, and UMSL's been pretty good in at that level. So, and not even WashU, which is a really good D3 program.
UMSL's got a Bob Sunvold down there, so
yeah, still a Sunvold.
I can say down there because it's literally down the road.
So now we've taken listeners way too deep into the levels of D2 and D3. USI's is beat Southern Illinois too. That was going to be the other thing I was going to get to. They beat SIU pretty handily over the weekend.
They didn't just like beat it. They won by 18
points.
Yeah,
they put a whooping on them, and SIU had won it. Oklahoma State. So I think that win, if USI has scaled up appropriately, that win may mature a little bit better than I think the Lindenwood one will. And the Penn game, Penn didn't play defense last year, and it does not appear they are committed to playing defense this year either. So
they can score though. They've got some guys who can score.
They run some fun stuff there. They are equipped on offense. They finally got some jump shooting, which they'd been searching for a long time. So, again, you know, I think the hard part here is Lindenwood is bad defensively, will be bad defensively. Penn has not shown any signs of improvement defensively. And even if USI is better than we expect, they're not going to probably be a top half of the, you know, better than median defense this year. So, it's fun to watch the offense. It's been fun to get impressions of them. How durable this efficiency is going to be questionable. I think as, you know, eventually as we start getting more KenPom data in, I think they might just slip because the quality opponents are going to take a hit. But just anecdotally, it's been fun to watch them play and fun to watch them, fun to get an early impression of them. But I'll flip it and say, you know, what's been your impression of this group, you know, over the first 120 minutes of basketball in the Dennis Gates era?
Well, it's I know that you do a lot of rewatches, you know, because you and Watkins kind of have the film room and you want to make sure you're kind of getting everything. It's always been pretty rare that I will rewatch a game. But I've not entire games, but I did rewatch most of Penn and rewatch most of the Lindenwood game. And mostly because, like, you know, sometimes when I'm running, you know, the Twitter account for the game, like, you don't watch as intently as maybe you would otherwise, and, like, you know, seeing kind of what they're trying to do offensively and what they're trying to do defensively, and, you know, why the other team is maybe shooting 50% from deep on them, and seeing if they're, like, you know, what kind of breakdowns defensively they have. You know, like, I will say, like, very clearly, any initial impressions that I think we thought we would have, I think so far, like, have been kind of unsurprising. You know, I think we expected them to be good offensively. I thought that, and I think we collectively had discussed this enough that we thought they would probably struggle a little bit defensively. And it certainly looks like that's going to be the case, that, you know, like, none of the issues that we sort of pointed out in previewing the season are going to be solved this year. Like, there's just no way that you can account for not having rim protection.
And the downstream consequences of that, which I think, you know, have probably been the most apparent, but we can get to that in a little bit. But it's not just rim protection from point blank range. There's other things that it's doing systematically to this group.
Yeah. I mean, it's forcing guys to approach their defense and their rotations and a lot of that stuff in different ways. You know, Noah Carter is 6'5", 6'6", and while he's, you know, he's got a solid body, and he can wall up against, you know, USI and Penn and Lindenwood and kind of get away with that. Like, that's not going to work against the SEC. And so, like, that's always going to be an issue for this team. And as long as fans are, like, prepared, my overall impression is that, like, if you have the correct expectations going into the season on what this team is and what they can be, you're going to really enjoy them because they're a fun team. Like, they play hard, they play fast. They're not afraid to shoot the ball offensively. When shots are going down, they're a whole lot of fun. And, like, they take care of the ball. And I think, like, one of the things that's a very easy turnoff for fans is like, sloppy basketball. When teams just struggle with, like, you know, the simple things.
Initiating offense.
Initiating offense, dribbling the basketball, passing the basketball. And this team seems all, you know, right now anyways, you know, very capable of doing all those things.
I think the defensively, we've got to have a discussion about what people expect from Muhammad Diarra, because I think that keeps being, to me, the thing that people misunderstand, may make it sound condescending, but I think people have overestimated the availability and the viability of him in year one. Like I wrote in his preview, it's not common for even really good JUCO bigs to come in and walk in and start. It's really rare. And so if you're expecting him to walk in and plug in and play frontline minutes, you're already expecting an outlier, you know, right there. And that's just going to lead to disappointment. I think the thing is, if you know, when we talk to scouts or when you watch him play, and I've talked to some people who kind of have, you know, gotten a sense for what his job is in year one there, it's going to be getting used to playing at this level, getting used to moving at this level. And like you saw it even against Lindenwood, there's a deer in headlights look when he's got to slip into drop coverage against Lindenwood, like, or even like try and move, you know, from the post and kind of maneuver around. Not that he can't do it. It's just that he's never been asked to play the five. He's always been playing in space as a perimeter guy. And it's just the job he's being asked to do is very different. The speed at which it's happening is very different. And, you know, I just think there's going to be some patience required there. But even then, he's going to be a guy who you hope you can get to 14 or 15 minutes a night, who you hope you can put out in some bigger lineups when you need to. And but you're really, like you said, you're going to be relying on Kobe. You're going to be relying on Noah Carter. You're going to be relying on Aiden Shaw, you know, to come over and provide some help for you. It's not going to be, you know, by, you know, next month, Modiar is going to be ready to go give you 28 minutes a game against Kansas. That's just not going to happen. And, you know, I think the one thing that that's contributed to is, you know, what we've seen defensively, which is a lot of selling out and over helping to the middle of the floor, where it's very clear there, you know, the thing is, you might wind up two passes away, but you got to get to the paint and provide some help, or at least get in the way. And it's produced, you know, a lot of open jumpers. I think until the Lindenwood game, Missouri was giving up 16 or 17 unguarded catch and shoots a game. So I think what you're seeing right now is the consequence, at least defensively, of a team that's undersized and trying to figure out how it can send a lot of bodies to the paint and still, you know, close out and still function. So what we've loved about them offensively is clear, but defensively, you know, how, you know, the lack of a big has manifested itself in a way that I don't think some people really would have expected, which is because Missouri's selling out to the middle of the floor, they're having to really give up a lot of jumpers to do it. So it's fascinating. You know, you always think about that theoretically, but when you see those trade-offs in real time, it's sort of like, okay, now I see what's happening here. And now I sort of understand, you know, what the situation is going to be moving forward. So that's sort of the other, I guess, you know, a little bit more downtrodden impression I have is there's going to be some consequences for the team's lack of size here. And it's better for us just to, you know, outline them now and just embrace it, that that's going to be the case, and that there's not a solution just parked on the bench that Dennis Gates isn't throwing out there. Because if there was a solution, I'm pretty sure he would grab it and not think twice.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's a very real clear reason why they were, you know, doggedly pursuing Jamarion Sharp, as, you know, they completely understood what they had in the middle, or what maybe what they didn't have is a more apt description. You know, just a missing body. And I think that while I think there's a lot to like about the roster, there's certainly, like, that is a big, giant missing gap on the roster where, and, you know, and I think maybe I was not quite fully in the optimistic, like, Diarra's going to start and average 20 and 10, you know, type of, I don't really think anybody was thinking that, but I thought he would be in the top eight. And maybe that's by the end of the year, he might still be. But I thought he would be in the top eight mostly out of necessity. But after watching these three games, I understand why he's not. I don't know exactly, like, where he falls in, like, the minutes. Like, he's got 5.8% of the minutes. But, yeah, like, Caleb Brown's at 19.2%. Isaiah Mosley's at 25, everybody else 40, 48, 57, 67, 59, 61, 65, 45. Yeah, so Diarra is definitely behind there. It is going to be a problem all season. And again, like, I'll go back to my earlier point, as long as you are prepared for Missouri having some defensive issues because of their lack of an anchor in the middle, then I think you're really going to have fun watching this team.
Yeah.
Because
they have ball handling, Sam. They have, again, against bad defenses, I'm sure the turnover numbers will go up as soon as they face stingier groups, but initial impressions, they have guys that can do more than just dribble the ball into the front court. They've got guys who can do what you expect from a point guard, which never thought I'd see the day, and I'm thrilled that it's here.
Yeah, so Nick Honor, he's a guy that I think a lot of people
undersold.
This isn't even like addressing, you know, Mizzou fans. This is like a national. Like, this is a media thing. Like, I really don't think enough people, like, bought into why Nick Honor was one of the better additions this past offseason. Just a really, really capable ball handler. A guy who, I mean, he's 7 of 18 from 3, which is about 39%. If he shoots that for the season, fantastic. That's great. I'm looking at his turnover rate.
Yep, that TO percentage, baby.
like 10.3%.
God, that's beautiful. It's so pretty.
You know, and like really, like Mizzou had like no turnover issues until the Lindenwood game when both Mosley and Sean East combined for 7 turnovers of a team. I think what they have 16, something like that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, like Mizzou's turnover rate, like they were just, you know, blowing their opponent out of the water with their BCI, which is something that has not happened in a while, Matt. Like, it's been a while. It's been a minute.
I'm not used to them winning the BCI battle 3-1. Like, just a utter
even,
domination.
Even, like, in Konzo's good years, you're still, like, you're pretty much saying, all right, their shooting has to be good enough to sort of overcome the fact that they're just going to turn the ball over. Like that's been really nice.
And the thing about it is, it's not even like the turnover rate again is 19. The assist rate's 19.1%. It's not like he's out here throwing dimes everywhere, but he's getting Missouri into good offense, into good sets. Where, and this is the thing, you know, Trey Gamillion is a guy who with an 8.2% turnover rate. Noah Carter 6.4. You know, even Kobe Brown is respectable at 15.9. Demoy Hodge 11.1. They're good passers. And I think that's the thing that, you know, you watch this team, they can beat you with the pass and they can beat you with ball movement and people and, you know, spacing and bot and player movement. You don't need a guy, you know, we'll have some film on him later this week of him working in, you know, some slot pick and rolls. But the thing about that is, you know, he's able to diagnose when to attack, when to move the ball. He's not breaking guys down with, you know, dribble combinations. But he's just really good at understanding when to probe, when to move the ball, when to set guys up. He understands how to use screens, which I think last year I had to stop watching because guys were like turning like they were an 18-wheeler around the screen and leaving just all kinds of space. He understands how to turn into screens. He knows how to, you know, back out and have his guy reset and re-angle on a screen. There's just stuff that you watch him do that you go, That's a veteran ball handler. That's a guy who knows what he's supposed to do. And it's just reassuring there. And even, you know, Sean East, you know, is a guy whose decision-making that I wish was a little better, but he's, you know, a guy who's going at high speed. So I think that there's some explanation for that. But Honor's just so steady. He just makes such good decisions, keeps the offense in time. It's really, really important. And it's probably the thing that I've enjoyed watching most is watching a guy who's just giving you competent, steady guard play out front. It's been do I seem happy that they have this now, Sam? Because I'm very, very, very pleased with this development. Please let it hold up.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember like when maybe it was when I was on with Brandon Weese and 550 KTRS talking like preseason and, you know, and
people
so much
asking
of the
about
focus,
Sean East.
Well, yeah, like so much of the focus of the season has been on Sean East because, I mean, with, you know, respect to Sean, like he was an incredible player at the JUCO level last year. He put up a lot of points. He drove a lot of the offense at one of the better junior colleges in the country. And so there was a lot of focus like, oh, like that, like this guy is a guy who's going to come in and solve Missouri's point guard problem. And I was just like, well, no, it's going to be Nick Honor. you could just go back. Like there's no way that you can account for the level of competition and going from junior college to the SEC. And, you know, again, with respect to Sean East, to, you know, I think is still kind of getting his bearings, and I think he can be a very good serviceable player and all that kind of stuff. Like there's a difference between a guy who went to UMass, went to Bradley, and went to JUCO, and was playing in those levels, and Nick Honor, who went from, what was he at, Fordham? Yeah, Fordham before Clemson, but spent the last 3 years playing at Clemson. One was a redshirt year before everybody had the free-for-all on the transfer. But 2 full years playing the ACC and doing that with such a low turnover rate, consistently not turning the ball over, consistently like being a consistent presence offensively, shooting the ball well. I just like, it was a no brainer for me that he was going to be the guy that was going to come in and be the starting point guard. It's very possible that at some point this season that Sean East is starting. But if he's starting, like he's starting with Nick Honor, and Nick Honor is the one and Sean East is the two, like that's the way it's going to go. Like Nick Honor, as long as he's healthy, is your starting point guard.
Yeah. The one thing that has been surprising to me is how, and I shared this yesterday, is just how quickly the on-ramp has been there for Aiden Shaw. I thought we'd get to the PT that he's seeing right now. I just thought it might be a little bit of a lower dosage early on, but he's already at around 15, 16 minutes a game. You know, I'm looking at his numbers right now. He's at 40% minutes, which is about typical for a freshman, you know, wing that had his recruiting rating. His, you know, usage and his possessions are lower than you might expect, but, you know, he's not a guy who is going to be ball dominant. He's a cutter. You know, a guy who runs the floor in transition, so it makes sense. A guy who already has an 18.4 defensive rebound rating, rebound percentage, which is really, really good for an undersized team. When he's on the floor, he gets on the glass. Some issues sometimes defensively from being overzealous, sometimes a little bit lost in rotation, stuff like that, but that happens. That's a freshman, but the guy makes things happen. Looking at him, trying to see what his block rate is. 2.8% block rate, which is not bad, considering that he kind of moves around and floats a little bit. 7 of 9 shooting at the rim. So he's doing well there. Just, I think that's the one thing I was sort of thinking was, okay, they're going to try and ease him in. They're going to maybe, you know, maybe they'll try Ryan DeGray a little bit at the four, but nope, they've gone right into Shaw getting 16 minutes a night and, you know, trusting him on the glass, you know, and letting him, I think, more than anything, letting him live through some growing pains defensively. I think that's, if anyone couldn't tell over the last 5 years, I thought, you know, the last staff had a little bit too quick of a hook with guys defensively. But Aiden gets to play through some issues and some mistakes. And, you know, I think that's going to really, really help him as the season moves forward. I think it's really going to speed up the learning curve for him. So a little bit surprised at how much he's played early on, but in a good way. But there's probably another name that folks are probably also surprised about, and not so much in a positive way, Samuel.
I'm guessing you want to talk about Isaiah Mosley.
Yeah, I'll let you have the floor on that topic to start with.
Well, yeah. I mean, part of it's like, I don't really know what to completely say about it, because we don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. We don't know, what the conversations with the staff is, what, like, he was told beforehand, what things have been going on and, you know, practice and off the court and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, as to why he didn't play against Penn, like, I don't know. Dennis Gates didn't put him in the game. It looked like he was available. He did not play. And it is a little confusing because, as I've said many times in study hall, like I watch somebody like DeAndre Golston and I see how he's useful. Like, I don't think he's a bad basketball player. But right now he's at 24.3% usage for this team, which, I mean, we tried that with Golston last year at Milwaukee.
It ended with
it didn't work out well.
It ended with a 92.6 O rating, and
he's at 95 right now.
Yeah,
he's gotten better, Matt. No, but like 95 offensive rating is not good. And it's like, I think we've kind of said this in private. I don't know if any one of us has sort of put it out in public, but you have to imagine at some point, like, that's where, Gates and the staff imagine possessions are going to go to Mosley, because Mosley is a proven offensive commodity. For now, though, it's not happening. Now, why is it not happening? Maybe, I don't know, maybe Mosley doesn't guard. Maybe he hasn't been, playing hard in practice. We're not there. We don't know what's going on, but there's something that those, the staff and Mosley sort of need to get on the same page to make sure that, because he's the guy that is going to be able to raise the ceiling on this team. If Mosley is a guy coming right now, getting, 25% of the minutes, then it's going to, they're just not going to win as many games in league play as if he's a guy that's, getting 60% of the minutes or 65, 70% of the minutes. Like, I don't think he needs to be an 85, 90% of the minutes guy, but he needs to be playing and he needs shots. And even in the game against Lindenwood, he was very clearly passing up shots, and some of those were a little surprising, but it's also maybe to the point where, they're trying to make sure he understands the offensive flow and how the offensive works, and then he can start getting his shots once he sort of understands the entire thing. I don't know. And it's just one of those things, I think we all expected more. We haven't gotten it, but it's also, it's three games in.
Yeah.
It's a new roster. We'll see how it goes.
It felt like,
hopefully he's ready by KU game, because I feel like that's a game where Isaiah Mosley will be ready to shoot the ball.
Yeah. He knows someone on the other bench, and he'll be eager to put forth his case for why he's an outstanding player nationally.
And not just the fact that he's good buddies with DeJuan Harris, but I think it's very clear that Bill Self wanted Kevin McCullough.
Yeah.
And not Mosley. So, Self went after McCullough and took McCullough for a spot that I think a lot of people thought, Isaiah Mosley would be a good fit for. And that's one of the reasons why, it came down to Mississippi State and Missouri. Cause I think a lot of people thought that Mosley really wanted to go to KU and play with his childhood buddy.
I thought last night was, it felt like a message being conveyed, whether it, I don't know what, tone, is it here?
Last night being the Lindenwood game.
At the Lindenwood game. The first five or six touches that he got in what you would consider to be advantageous spots on the floor and within the offense were passes. And there were two or three where there was one that was kind of a slip and roll with, I think, Noah Carter, where Noah's diving to post, not even putting a hand up, his back's turned, he's diving to post up, and Mosley throws a jump pass and it's out of bounds. There's another one where, but the defender had gone under the screen. He had all kinds of room. He could have, pulled up and shot a jumper. There was another one later on in the second half where defender again trails a little bit, and there's a cutter. Aiden's trying to go back door, but there's clearly a help defender sitting on the midline, and he tries to throw a bounce pass and thread it, and it gets picked off when he could have turned the corner and gone to a one dribble pull-up, which he usually is pretty good at getting to out of that action. So it was, like you said, there were just some moments last night where I thought, okay, the read here is even that you should look to hunt for the shot, there was a clear conscious effort to pass. There were a couple though that I thought he made that were, I think, really, really good. The lasso pass in transition where he gets deep and finds Nick Honor was really, really good. The lob in transition was a good one on point. I thought he made some good passes, but he had, I think, four or five turnovers. I think a couple of them were him just hunting the pass instead of hunting a shot that was there for him. So I guess that's my thing, is I get why Gates would want him to sort of settle into the broader culture of the offense, of moving the ball, And Missouri gets a lot of side-to-side action. You know, they have really good screeners, really good rollers. They've got guys that connect pieces really well. And you don't want Mosley to be a ball stopper. But there's some situations, especially if they are running some continuity ball screen stuff, where you have an opening and you can go get your bucket. Go, and you can get to your spot. Go get it. And I think that that's sort of the thing here, is was Mosley trying to demonstrate, look, I'm willing to give the ball up. Is that what it's going to take for him to have some trust reciprocated to where, okay, maybe Dennis lives with, you know, him shot hunting a little bit instead of moving the ball. So that's just what fascinated me, is just watching kind of the decision-making process and maybe what was trying to be conveyed or what sort of the direction was there. Because when we talk about fitting into the offense, I don't think it necessarily means scheme. I think it's much more of the mentality of, you know, is Dennis going to, you know, make some room and some concessions for Mosley to kind of go get his, and can Mosley sort of, you know, check his scorer's instinct a little bit. And it feels like that's what we're negotiating right now. Not like, you know, does the offense fit, or is, you know, he a good locker room guy? It just feels like we have two people trying to negotiate, you know, what kind of concessions they're willing to make in order to make the fit, you know, kind of, I think, come a little faster than, and or come in a way that we all sort of expected it to.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be like one of those things that we're just going to kind of have to consistently track. I mean, it's just there's no real clear answer early. You know, but I also think like there's a reason why, you know, Dennis Gates and who's this DOB? Whoever was putting the schedule together.
Ryan Charbaugh, I think.
Charbaugh's, is he the Dobo? Is he the, is he the assistant to the head coach?
There's so many guys, so many slots here. Let me...
There's like 47 staff members now. So,
which is a good thing, which is a good thing.
Yeah, there's not like three guys. It's like, it's hard to miss with the previous staff. You know exactly who is doing what.
Chase Goldstein is the director of, is the Dobo for them.
Okay. Yeah. But the schedule was crafted this way for a reason. It was meant to give Gates and his roster time to like figure things out. It's beneficial that, you know, that you have basically like, you know, 8 or 9 games where you're going to be able to do a lot of experimenting and figure out like what you're going to do with maybe your best offensive weapon in Isaiah Mosley, and how you're going to kind of get him to work within everything else that you have. Cause like, that's one of the things that, and maybe this is something that was slightly overlooked as we were kind of getting ready for the season. Mosley at Missouri State was an ISO machine. So many of his possessions, you know, came in isolation, one-on-one. And like, that's just not going to be beneficial offense for Missouri. Now, in the Valley with a guy like Mosley, it's going to work a lot of the time. But for it to work at the SEC level, like, Mosley's going to have to do it within the structure of the offense, because he's got good offensive players around him. Like, you can trust Nick Honor, you can trust Kobe Brown, you can trust Noah Carter. Like, you know, Demoy Hodge is phenomenal off the ball. You know, like, Trey Gamillion's obviously shown that he can make shots. You know, if Aiden Shaw is streaking towards the rim and he's anywhere remotely free, just put it in the vicinity and he can catch it and dunk it. Like there are a lot of pieces that you can make useful. And I think this entire process, I have to believe anyway, that the entire process here is Gates is trying to bring Mosley along in a way that's going to make him as effective as he can be by the time we're hitting like conference play.
Yeah. Otherwise, I look up and down, you know, when I look at the minute distribution here, and this is something I've shared, there's been so much tinkering with the lineups. Sometimes you're like, okay, what's the pecking order? And then the best thing to do is look at the aggregate picture. and the minutes really make sense. You know, they kind of, I think, conform to what we thought going into the preseason, you know, Mosley being accepted. But, you know, as soon as they took Isaiah Mosley to 14 minutes, Caleb Brown's allocation took a dip. You know, they've kind of moved him between combo and wing. So if you're going to give him another 14, let's say you split that evenly, that maybe takes 7 minutes away from DeAndre Golston. Now Golston's down around 30% of minutes per game, and maybe it's going to take, you know, take down, you know, maybe a little from Easton Hodge, depending on how they want to structure lineups. But the thing about it is, that's really the only thing that kind of stands out here is, you know, I think if you were to say, well, the impression here was that maybe DR is a little bit lower in the pecking order than we thought, which makes sense if the defense isn't quite there, if he's not quite understanding the scheme yet. And if you're trying to bring Mosley along slowly, you got to find a way to, you know, fill in minutes at the wing in the combo spot. So that's naturally Caleb and DeAndre's sort of position. But everything else has sort of really made sense here. You know, it's Kobe, it's Noah, it's Des Moines, it's Nick. And, you know, Chameleon's working his way into the mix. Sean East kind of comes in as a secondary ball handler. Like, it all, you know, Aiden Shaw is a little bit farther ahead, like I said earlier, so he's kind of at the four now. But if in the preseason we would have said all those guys are probably going to be in line for top 8 or 9. So it really, the combinations and sort of the rotations themselves still probably have a way to go, and they're probably still going to do some, you know, tinkering there. But in aggregate, really, I think the kind of minutes distribution has kind of broken down the way we expected it to.
Well, so one of the things that I think I always kind of like to give you a little trouble about is how you like to say that, you know, this isn't surprising. I've ribbed you enough, like, in our Slack chat when you're not surprised by an outcome. So I want to talk about what does surprise you, Matt. So this, obviously, like, 3 games in, there has been a lot of play that we've realistically expected to see. Like, I think there's a lot of things that we're not surprised by. What have you, like, what's been the one positive surprise so far in the first 3 games? You know, I know that you kind of talked about Aiden Shaw, but I'm going to make you pick a different one.
I'm trying to think what here, what you try and prepare so much. I think, you know, you watch Trey Chameleon, and, you know, watching 6 or 7 games of Cleveland State, and you kind of are limited. So you're always sort of on the sample size, like, about, you know, you get a little piece of it, and, you know, you think you get a broad sort of approach. But when I was talking to coaches in the spring about him, they just said, that guy's the heart of everything that they do. And it's, they said, you know, when you put on tape, you just see him do all these little things that, you know, lift a team up. And you think, okay, that's hokey and whatever, but you see it live. You know, they'll, you know, Isaiah Mosley will throw a pass that's a little bit off, and the first guy over to say, Hey, let's move on. Next play, that's Trey. If it's the guy on the floor, first guy over to help him up, it's Trey. First guy to celebrate a lob with any sort of any sort of exuberance out of the frame, it's Trey. I think so. You like seeing that it's everything you thought it was gonna be from a cultural perspective. And then I thought in the pin game late, you know, I always hate the cliche of it doesn't show up in the box score, but that guy gets to a 50-50 ball. Keeps it alive. Another teammate gets a rebound. That guy rotates on time to be there, you know, to force a guy to move the pass. You know, it's not even a shot, but Penn had been hunting, you know, kind of these little pick and pops with Jonah Charles, and he's there to force Charles to reverse the ball. Or even he just, you know, when he hits the three where he gets fouled on, you know, he drifts. He does a great job relocating. He recognizes where his guy is. He sees the passing angle, and he relocates to the spot. So I think it's surprising to see all the little ways that I think he keeps, you know, the team in time, and he kind of keeps, you know, the energy level where it needs to be. And you can see why, you know, he's an extension of Gates. So it's been surprising to see just how much that sort of has translated and carried over, because you feel like sometimes people overplay that angle, but it's at least early on, it seems like that there's a genuine sort of truth to that, and that's been nice to see.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I feel like I would agree with that, and almost to an extension, like I would rope in Demoy Hodge, and I was critical of Hodge's play in our Slack conversation at the beginning of the game against Lindenwood. I thought Hodge started off the game and just was not very good, which to me was like one of the standout things the first two games is how active he is defensively, how good he is sort of getting to the rim. I mean, he's attempted 21 three-pointers, which is in three games, Matt, that's an average. This is some quick math, so forgive me if I'm incorrect, but that's an average of 7 threes a game. And 28.6% from three-point range ain't great. So I would like to see Demoy like make more outside shots. I don't know that he's a guy that, like, I don't need him to shoot 40%, but I feel like
33%.
Yeah, 33 to 35% should be reachable. But I love how, like, he just gets out and goes and attacks the rim. His cuts are good, like his timing is so good, his hands are so quick. He's a really fun player to watch. And as I think part of my frustration of watching him, you know, in the first half against Lindenwood was,
he didn't feel like the activity levels was what you expected from him.
Yeah. Like he didn't look like the guy that I watched the two previous games. And I mean, I just like, I think this sort of extends to the overarching theme, I think, of our podcast here, which is that this is like, they're just a fun team to kind of watch. And really, if you're nitpicking, you know, Demoy Hodge's energy level in the first half against Lindenwood, like there are a lot of things going right so far, this early in the season. And it doesn't like cover up the very clear issues that they're going to have defensively and the roster, holes that we know that they have. You know, I've enjoyed watching this team play basketball for three games.
I think that's, you know, this is, again, I respected, you know, Consuel Martin as a person and, you know, how he tried to, you know, run the program. But how many times would we say the things he talked about all offseason, that has not manifested itself on the floor at all? Like, there, I think that's been my, you know, to take it back to where we started, my biggest surprise is, you know, the pitch for the show has matched what I'm actually seeing on the screen. And I think that's sort of heartening to see, okay, it wasn't just you sitting in front of a mic saying, we're going to play faster. And then you just gave into your conservatism. And I think there's, you know, fans have, you know, tweeted me going, does Dennis Gates do anything on the sidelines? It's just such a different thing to watch a team that, you know, Konzo would probably have considered playing out of control. And, you know, Konzo, you could hear his voice and almost, it was almost omnipresent, and you don't hear Gates at all. It's such a stark contrast to hear nothing from Gates, but just see this pace that you would think Zoe would be going absolutely bonkers at. But then to watch, you know, a former team, you know, the last couple of years where they really aren't playing all that fast. And it just seems like Zoe's constantly coaching and encouraging and doing stuff. So it's just, it's been a different change. It's been a surprising change, and it's, you know, it's something you really can't, you know, envision until you see it live and viscerally. So that, it's been a surprise to see that, you know, the pitch is matched up in reality. So that's sort of another surprise there, at least to me.
Well, and that's really like, you know, that's an extension of, really like that's how John Wooden coached. And that's how like Leonard Hamilton coached. Like Leonard Hamilton has never been like a guy running up and down the sidelines. You know, and I don't necessarily like there. I don't really think like it's a right way or a wrong way.
No,
you know, but I am a big believer that like the in-game coaching thing, and really for like probably more so basketball than, you know, than maybe football. That it's a little overblown, because I feel like if you're doing your job well as a coach, then you should be able to just sit there like John Wooden on in your chair and just watch your team play.
Dennis Gates' job is to do what he did the other night, which is draw up a really nice ATO. Like, get the guys around. Here's what we're going to run. You know, this is the base set. Let's go do it. Let's execute it. Like, that's his job. That's what you're paying him for on game day.
Well, right. And you know, to his credit, like, I think, you know, Martin did that. I think, like, Eric Musselman does a good job of doing that. I think there's a lot of coaches that are, you know, that do that part of it. It's just, are you a guy who, you know, as you're on the bench and you're watching your team play, are you a guy who's going to yell at them and make sure that they're remembering everything that you're teaching, or are you a guy that's just going to let them play and figure it out? And I coach under a guy who is very much the first guy and very, very successful doing it. You know, I played for different kinds of guys. And I think it's one of the things I so far have been impressed with the preparedness, I guess is the right way to say it, of Dennis Gates and his program. They look ready to play. They move the ball well. They run good offense. Is there some defensive stuff that maybe they need to clean up? Yeah, but
you know why it's happening. You can,
yeah, like there are legitimate roster reasons why. You know, they're trying to, you know, paper over a very, you know, glaring hole. You know, so yeah, I would say, like, I'm at this point pretty impressed. I want to obviously see how he's able to, you know, bring along Isaiah Mosley. And obviously, like, how things look once the competition level ramps up a bit. But you know, I think this team competes. I think they play hard.
And I
think he's doing his job.
And they're gonna fill the hole next year. They went out and they got bigger, longer bodies for next year. So they have addressed that with the signing class last week. I don't know how.
Yeah, I was gonna start with that, and like as soon as we got into the pot, I'm like, ah, crap, I totally farted on that one. So good bringing that back up. Thanks, Matt.
Always here to help you when you need it most.
Seeing as that we're at the end of the podcast, yes, Missouri in the middle of the week last week.
Haven't talked about these recruits at numerous
times.
Yeah,
like we've talked about them plenty. It's not a matter of us not talking about the recruits, but all three guys signed, so
no drama.
I like it.
We'll see what they do in spring. They're supposedly watching another big, Braden Pierce, who's now at IMG Academy, 3-star kid who's kind of, I think, you know, put together a nice fall as coaches got into IMG and saw him. You know, if he was a guy that you took in spring, he's another 7-foot big. You know, if you got another young big, I'd be fine with that. Stockpile him. I think he's more of a traditional post with alongside Jordan Butler, who, as we've talked about, can kind of space out and play out in space a little bit. That wouldn't be a bad pickup if that kid, you know, IMG's going to play a really, really tough schedule. They're going to play some of the best prep schools in America. If he looks like he holds up against that competition, then I don't think that would be a bad developmental guy to bring in. And then, you know, you maybe have 2 or 3 spots if you have to go into the portal. But good class. It's going to, right now, it's currently top 20. It's 19th in 247's composite.
There's still possibility that Chris Parker might still be in the conversation, which until he makes the campus, I'm going to be hesitant to believe how deep Missouri is there. But apparently, like, what, he and CY are just besties.
They're still tight, apparently.
And that rumor just won't die.
It won't die until, you know, I won't give it any more credence until there's an official visit announced and he is coming to campus. But
there's an official visit or he's committed to someplace else. Like, one or the other has to happen before it's like, all right, maybe this is going somewhere. So yeah, Chris Parker and who was the other kid's name?
Braden Pierce.
Braden Pierce. Otherwise, we're looking at the portal.
Yep. But I think fans will be happy. It's probably going to be one of the best classes in the last decade that they've signed. So clearly addressing some need, especially getting some more size onto the roster. So those guys will be
and
here.
Possibly bringing back like quite a few good players. Like, you know, Gates apparently like wants to bring Kobe back. So
if he's open
bring
to that,
Kobe, you bring Noah, you bring Nick Honor back.
That's just fine. Those are good players. It would be nice to have them around. The last thing I'll say is the optimistic thing here is this has not been a great schedule. We've panned it. You know, I don't think there's any way you can, even if you're, you know, rational like we are, and you rationalize kind of the process here that they used to get there, they have not taken a bad loss here. And then, as we saw in week one, there were plenty of teams out there that got picked off in bye games. So, you know, people can say, oh, Missouri did what they needed to do. There was some carnage last week out there. I don't know what everybody did to make the SWAC mad, but they're after everybody right now. They are tired of you sending them to Dayton every year. They are tired of you not even putting them in the main bracket. And by God, they are out for blood and revenge right now. Colorado didn't escape. Texas Southern picked off. Arizona State. I think Wichita State lost Alcorn.
Alcorn State also gave Ole Miss like a serious fight. Like they were in it until late in the second half.
They were in it. So you know what that means? Don't overlook Mississippi Valley State coming here. Don't overlook them.
Well. Let's not get carried away by the team that just got beat by 29 points by Yale.
That is a contrast in cultures right there. Itabena, Mississippi, and New Haven, Connecticut.
Grambling's got Cartier Gordon, who is approximately a 24-year-old junior in college.
Hey, look, that kid, as you know, probably better, you know, than anyone, has had his own road. And it is good that he's found a place. He's getting to play basketball.
Absolutely.
And it's fantastic, you know, that he's going to get a chance to, you know, at least have, you know, the opportunity to play at this level and, you know, kind of reboot his career there. And they picked off Colorado when they came in to North Louisiana. So don't sleep on them. But there was nothing given last week. And as we saw tonight, FAU,
Colorado beat Tennessee.
that's the worst I've seen Tennessee look defensively in a while. They couldn't.
Oh man,
they couldn't guard horns actions or middle ball screens. They couldn't do it. And the best part was the way the camera was set up. You would just see Rick Barnes just absolutely flabbergasted, like arms crossed, and he just like drop him to the side into fists. He was just so irate. There was no screaming, but the body language said everything. And it's as upset as I've seen Rick in a while. But we have SIU Edwardsville tonight. This podcast is dropping on Tuesday. SIU Edwardsville is in town. Mississippi Valley State arrives on Sunday. And then things kind of start getting into a little bit more of a spaced interval with Coastal Carolina and Houston Christian, nay, Houston Baptist, coming next week. That Coastal Carolina game is looking like it might be sneaky. They're at 178 in KenPom. But other than that, the sub 50.
They have not played anybody yet. Well, they played St. Mary's of Maryland and Methodist of somewhere.
It's not a directional Methodist school? Just Methodist?
Just Methodist. I've just got the KenPom profile.
Yeah, and then they step up to
they beat Methodist 110-47. So I can't imagine Methodist deserves a directional school there.
USC Upstate. Jeez. Oh, they don't even have. Oh, this is. I thought Missouri was soft. This is something else. And there's Regent University. Three non-KenPom programs on Coastal Carolina. All right, we've delayed this outro long enough, but
Yeah, it's time to get out of here. Because now that the season is here, Matt, we are gonna have to do this on a more regular basis. So with that all being said, thanks everybody for tuning in. Make sure that you are subscribed to our podcast feed. You can subscribe through Apple Podcasts, the Google Play Store, also through Spotify. We are on Spotify. If you're a subscriber, you can get the latest episodes before the box score and hear Nate and BK talk all about Missouri football and Eli Drinkwitz contract extensions, which is apparently
no one's talking about
conversation
it.
Here. No one's talking. Might as well talk about that and not blowouts at Tennessee. But you will probably also
you get all of it.
Enjoy reading all the content we have going on rock'emnation.com. Matt, I'm really pretty happy with our coverage right now. We've got people covering women's basketball. We've got wrestling ramping up. Football is in its last few weeks here. Men's basketball, you and Watkins are doing good stuff. Film room is gonna hit a nadir here soon, I think. And yeah, I think that's it. Make sure you follow Matt on Twitter at MattJHarris85. Also, give that Matt Watkins dude a follow at DataMizzou. He and Harris here are much more frequent tweeters than I am, but
Twitter's still alive.
Sam T. Snelling, despite Elon's best efforts, Twitter is still hanging by a thread. We do have a backup ready to go, and if it's needed, we'll be ready. But everybody, yeah, be on the lookout for maybe a link to a Discord channel should things start really going sideways at twitter.com. Yeah, that's it. We'll be back next week with another pod. We'll talk more Mizzou hoops. Until then, thanks everybody for tuning in.